begin.
Good morning.
Good morning. A few more folks may trickle on in, but I think we're at time, and I have my press agent here, my mom, as you can see.
Yay.
Yay, mother.
She's the nurse for 50 plus years that I mentioned in one of the sessions, nurse and educator. And actually, this is the very first time that my partner Allison gets to hear me, other than at Best for Ourselves.
Where's Allison?
So where's Allison?
She's the bookmaker. I'm, for the record, for the recording, I'm Anna Marie Vegan, and I'm a professor of ethics at Loyola University in Chicago. I focus a lot on healthcare and medical ethics, in particular racial ethnic disparities and socioeconomic disparities. And it is a privilege to get to teach both graduate students and undergraduate students, and to be a Lutheran in a Jesuit context, and also to really push the envelope on the social justice questions that aren't always given enough attention among bioethicists. And it's really been wonderful to speak with people who are pastors, chaplains, healthcare providers, healthcare administrators, to have such a multidisciplinary dialogue this week. It's really been just delightful for me and thought-provoking. So today is really, as I said in the very beginning of the week, for those of you who heard, I really believe that a fundamental task of ethics is to be constructive, to equip people and empower people with what are we going to do with the problems that we face. Because if you have to do a very thick and long and detailed description and analysis of the problems, because they are very complex. So you have to go through that. It's kind of like being very present to Good Friday. You've got to wrestle with the complexity. But then if you end there, as sometimes ethics does, then it just leads to cynicism and moral lethargy and complacency and people sitting on the couch watching a lot of TV because they're so damn depressed. So I feel a real strong calling to say, yeah, it is bad, and in the face of that, what are we going to do? So that's what we'll talk about today. And I want to talk about, you haven't heard me speak a lot about theological insights, but I think that they are there, and I think that those of us who are people of faith but don't necessarily feel comfortable with the way that religion is sometimes used in public discourse in this country, that we have kind of muted or muffled our faith convictions because we don't want to be associated with others. And yet, I think that's really done a disservice to the depth of the public dialogue, and also to show that, you know, Christians have a lot of different theological constructs and a lot of different ideas to offer, and our interpretations and our voices matter just as much as those with whom we might disagree, and yet those who get more airtime. So let me spend just a couple of minutes talking about these five, and then I want us to think collectively about what things that we want to try and do and take home, and I'm going to suggest resources and organizations that can help you be a part of the dialogue for reform on the national level and the international level. So what do Lutherans bring to the table? What can we offer, even if we can't own the debate, control the debate, we can't force everyone to agree? What I think we can do as people of faith is say, you know what, here are some metaphors out of our tradition. You may or may not see points of connection with your tradition, but let's put them on the table. Let's expand the moral imagination, expand the vocabulary. Instead of thinking about patients only as customers or clients, what happens when you think of them as children of God or the divine? Now, secular hospitals may not want to write that into their mission statement, but if you speak with individual caregivers as well as patients, and you just, again, or in your own churches, have a dialogue and think about, well, who are these people that are seeking care? Who are these people that are giving care? Is the market relationship, I'm purchasing insurance, purchasing provision of care, is that the best way to think about it? Or can we add some other words as well? So the first one that is certainly in strong and Lutheran circles and tradition is neighbor love. Sometimes, and in certain periods of history, Lutherans have been rightly criticized for, quote unquote, sitting on our justified behinds. Since by the grace of God and through faith we are justified, we don't have to do anything. And in fact, I don't think I will. That is sometimes how Lutherans are characterized, sometimes fairly, sometimes not. But in Luther, there is a rich and astounding tradition of neighbor love. If you ever look at the Large Catechism, take a look at his explanation of what the Ten Commandments mean. He says in that, that, can you hold off a little bit for this answer? He says in the explanation of the Ten Commandments that murdering someone, thou shalt not kill, that's not simply going and taking a hatchet to someone. He says quite boldly, anytime you deny food and clothing and well-being to another, you neglect them, you stand aside and see them suffering, you have as much as killed them. That's a profound social ethic right there. He also was the whole 95 Theses and the indulgences, that was a profound socioeconomic critique of how the poor were being taken advantage of, have their little pittances go to try to spring souls out of purgatory when their needs were not being met in terms of work and food and shelter. So in Luther, although it's not always fully recognized, there is a lot of understanding of how we are very much interdependent and accountable to one another. In fact, he rails against what he would say, those people who puff themselves up and thinks that they are very self-righteous and self-satisfied and neglect the needs of others. So neighbor love for him is a very rich concept, and we now, in our time, need to expand it to think about neighbor love beyond the point of immediate contact with the most immediate neighbors. So not only the people that live down the street or in our congregation or in our communities or in our nations, but the people who really irritate us, or the people that we have no idea what their lives are like, whether they live in very far foreign countries, they are of a religious tradition that we know nothing about or don't really like or respect, they have very different political views than we do. However we want to conceive of the other, that's our neighbor. So yes, for me, I have to think of conservative evangelical Christians as my neighbor, and that is my challenge, to keep thinking about how to stay in dialogue and relationship, because no one is left out. No one can, although in some of Luther's writings he does say very harsh things about the Turks and the Jews and things like that, and the papists, but ultimately I think if you look at the larger thread in Luther's thought and in later Lutheran theology, the idea is that everyone counts, everyone matters, everyone's in the fold. You can't simply draw the circle and then let the others be on the outside. So we can think about neighbor, and similarly we can think about children of God. Again, it's the same thing. The people that most get under your skin, that most irritate you, that are most difficult to understand or sympathize with, whatever the stereotypes are, whether it be because they're closed-minded, or because they're selfish, or because they're lazy, or because they have drug addiction problems, or because they speak funny because you don't like their religion, those folks are the children of God. Those are especially the children of God that need to be under radar screen, not the add-ons. So when you are giving care in the hospitals, and I often talk about this with providers, and they have great stories about the patients that just, they want to pull their hair out, because patients can be very irritating, you know, just so can providers. But I mean, you know, when you're trying to give good care, and you're trying to do good things for people, and they are ornery, they're unappreciative, they don't follow through with orders, they don't respect you, they don't show up on time. Is there a way of keeping the patients and keeping engaged with them if you think in terms of these metaphors and not only as I have a contract to fulfill with this consumer or this patient? It's still going to be frustrating, it's still going to be difficult, but again, it's just about enriching the dialogue. I think Lutherans have a wonderful tradition of confessing our collective sin, and there's individual sin that is often confessed, but I think we really need to press the point that sin is not simply individual or moralistic, that it is social, structural, systemic, in other words. We sin in the United States as a people in terms of how little we have done for others with huge health issues in the two-thirds world. We sin in this country, I would say, in our lack of fully addressing health care inequalities in this country. And it's not so much about individual sinning, but that we have created systems and structures and economic policies that at the get-go advantage some over others. We need to name that as sin. The Vatican, in fact, recently added sins to the list, new sins to the list, that include polluting the environment and gross excesses of wealth. The Catholics have a sense of what this, and they do, and Catholic social teaching has a rich understanding of social sin. We Lutherans could really benefit from exploring that and naming it more clearly. So you can see, perhaps, those of you who have heard Merritt Trelstead, that she and I have a few differences, because although we're both feminists, I really do focus on the U.S. context and the affluence in terms of naming sin. And whereas I see that the cross does not have a redemptive value for people that, who have been victimized, there are a whole lot of really wealthy, puffed up folks that I think could use a little more of theology of the cross and understanding of their own participation in sin, as well as my own. It always has to be not simply projecting it outward and getting mad at whatever communities you want to get mad at, but that critical self-reflection that is always needed, ongoing, about how our own hearts get hardened and warped. That's why I love Luther's emphasis on how we are always simultaneously saved and sinner. Not simply worms or terrible people that should feel awful and guilty about ourselves, but not simply God so precious and beloved that we aren't held accountable. The paradox of both and instead of either or. If we contributed nothing else, we could contribute so much because Lutherans get paradox. We get and or. And our society oftentimes likes both and. Sometimes my head gets ahead of my mouth. Instead of either or. That's how oftentimes things are characterized. Whereas both and builds coalitions. Both and kind of thinking builds understanding across differences. And I think this is what is powerful about some of Barack Obama's rhetoric, is that he's able to connect with folks from a lot of different communities and the independents instead of just playing in the traditional rules of Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative. So if we can help hold these things in tension with each other, instead of saying to people, yeah, you're right, you have to choose a side, if we can lend this paradoxical appreciation, holding things in tension, things that seem mutually contradictory are maybe just both important because they mutually correct one another. See what I mean? Then, the common good. Now that's something that is in the Lutheran tradition, but I really have to credit Catholics with developing it much more richly. That to think of what is good and what is right, not again only in individual terms, but what is in our best interest. What does the world most need? How many drugs do we need for insomnia or restless legs versus multi-drug resistant TB and making sure that the malaria drugs get out there? Do my needs always need to come first? And again, I'm speaking from a position of privilege. If I am someone who has been not heard and not ignored, I mean, who has not been heard and who has been ignored and marginalized and silenced, then this does not, context matters, so that it's not the same. But I'm speaking specifically for people like myself who have enough money, who have good insurance, who have good access to health care, who live in the United States, who don't yet wonder about where they're going to go if they have a medical emergency. We need to think. The people that can go ahead and do Botox or laser resurfacing or other nips and tucks here and there, is that what we want to prioritize? Should that come first just because we can afford it or because our insurance will pay for it? The idea is thinking of the collective good and realizing that when you use resources, they aren't there for other people. Now, I'm not encouraging you to stay away from the doctor, to not get your prescriptions filled, to avoid medical procedures that are life-saving. I don't want you to hear that either. But sometimes I think when we only think of healthcare as an entitlement or as an individual commodity that we buy through our participation in our work plans and such, we miss these larger questions of distribution and equity. Yes, go ahead.
Can you give an example of, you mentioned a minute ago that the Catholics have been a real good model on the priority of the common good. Is there an example that you can provide? Or I didn't mean to interrupt your talk. But you're
well, this book by Lisa Cahill, Theological Bioethics, is excellent. On common good language, social ethics that is also bioethics. That is not simply individualistic or moralistic in its tone. It's wonderful, wonderful. So I would start here. And she's got a million footnotes. So, and it's in the bookstore.
There's a strong theology in Catholicism, or a strong emphasis in Catholicism across conservative to more liberal Catholics on social justice. All of our... that it is an imperative to be concerned about social justice if you're a Catholic.
And in this country, when you think about the fight against child labor and labor unions and Dorothy Day and all of that and the industrialization of the United States early 20th century, Catholics were at the forefront of a lot of that, and some Protestants as well. But
the good old Jesuits.
Yeah, those Jesuits, I tell you. So it's definitely there. So then the next one that I would like to speak about is simply, let me see. Oh, and I think the thing about common good is it's a powerful corrective to an overemphasis on autonomy and individual rights and consumerism. It's a powerful, it speaks a powerful word to the what I call an entitlement syndrome. If I can buy it, if my insurance will pay for it, I can get it. I deserve it. I want it. Mm-hmm. Done. That's what ethics becomes. Whether you're talking the beginning of life or end of life or somewhere in between.
And don't limit my choices.
Yeah, because I'm an autonomous free agent. Mm-hmm. You know, autonomy in traditional bioethics, it's beneficence, non-maleficence, justice, and autonomy is the four principles that you're supposed to work with and apply to figure out what to do. But I think a lot of times autonomy reigns number one. Because, again, speaking in a generalization, in the United States, we have become very accustomed as a culture, as a people, to having our individual rights respected and heard, and don't tread on me, which was really important, and is really important. But it has to be held in tension with those other three, justice, non-maleficence, and beneficence. And justice, and social justice. Yes?
Well, just briefly, Farmer was an individual who started something, and then it became a communal sort of thing. And that's what we have to learn to do, is to be the individual who then is open, and it isn't mine.
Yeah.
You know.
It is, and he's very, it's a very, very strong difficult on, yeah, empowering other people. And he also says something else that I'm glad you reminded me, because I'm going to read you something in just a minute. The last thing that I want to say that I think we offer as Christians, and Lutherans in particular, is a deep recognition of human mortality and imperfection. I don't see the goal of science or medical technology as changing the fact that we are still going to die, and that some of our children are not going to make it, and some of our pregnancies are not going to go to full term. I think sometimes there is the expectation, because we get very, very excited about the possibilities on the frontiers of medicine, that we could extend our lives, it seems, almost infinitely. I mean, insurance policies, somebody told me this recently, that they are now writing policies for people to live up to like 100 or 150 years because they want to make sure they've got all their bases covered. That's like, and it used to be 100, and now, you know, it's just getting pushed out, so.
Well, like that film clip you did yesterday about the best of you, it's going to be your child, but the best of you, when they were selecting which embryo would be the one to take.
Right, right. It's still you, just the best of you.
Right.
So I think it comes up in a lot of areas in terms of end-of-life care and how long we try. It's interesting because the same technology, for example, ventilators, could be in some cases excessive and extraordinary because it's higher brain death. There is no recovery. Or it could be absolutely ordinary care. This person, for a limited time, needs a ventilator because they're recovering from surgery. So it's not like we can simply say feeding tubes are ridiculous or extraordinary care, or ventilators, or resuscitating someone's heart. It depends again on the context and what the likelihood of is of recovery and such, and costs and risk benefits analysis, that kind of thing.
And it seems to, it seems to be taken out of, looked at out of context with all the other global issues, ecology, how long can the world support that many people living to 100 or 110 years old, and the population density and what have you. And it seems to be, when people look at medical technology, they look at it in isolation.
Yeah, and that's where I think, as we mentioned the other day, Oregon has a really interesting model to help us think about priorities and the fact that healthcare is a good but a limited good. We only have so many hours in a day, so many providers, so much medicine, so many, even the United States, it prides itself in having great state-of-the-art equipment. It takes only so many people can use that in a given day. So
Donna?
Yeah.
I want to connect to deep recognition of human mortality and a sense of sinfulness. Sin as imperfection and limited, maybe that's not always sin, but it seems to be one thing that is often missing in the American medical system is a recognition that the healthcare providers are ordinary human beings.
Uh-huh.
And so, theologically, if we come either as providers or as patients, not to expect everything to always work. And so, an example of that, they wasn't talking about it theologically, but there's a nice piece in the Minneapolis paper about Children's Hospital where they now have institutional policy that if a mistake, if you know there was a mistake in the procedure, to say so, and to say that to the family.
Yeah.
In that coverage, one thing that was fascinating to me is they showed that in cases of malpractice, there are many cases of malpractice where one of the team said, I'm sorry, this didn't work, we did the wrong thing, or it wasn't adequate, and that person is often excluded from the malpractice.
There's other research that I've seen that if you are so afraid of litigation that you don't admit making a mistake, so that it can start a lot of healing, and it does stop some of those lawsuits. Not always.
And that's, there's a certain prudence factor there that probably is going on at a place like Children's, but I think religiously, on both sides, when I'm a patient, if I don't hold up to my doctor, you have to fix this, and I know you have the power to fix it, and you've got to fix it for me.
Yeah.
And if she doesn't have that expectation, if we all know, we're human beings here.
And we hope.
We're doing the best we can.
We hope and we try.
We're doing the best we can.
And not beating the disease does not mean failure, necessarily.
Right, exactly.
It means that you're human.
Right, exactly.
Both as a provider and as a patient.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know exactly where that fits up there. Maybe it's a kind of...
Well, it's part of confession of sin, but it's also part of, definitely, a deep recognition
of our
mortality.
Theological anthropology that I think is really important.
Who we are, meaning theological anthropology, meaning who we are if we really believe that there is a God and that God, our relationship to God says something about who we are as human beings. So I think, Deanne, you've mentioned, and I said this earlier, a little eye-opener that several folks came to, way to go. There are some idols going on. One is medical science and technology. Another one is the sense that we could become perfect and immortal, and that or imperfect, that we could have perfect children, and as well as perfect lives, and that could go on forever and ever, seemingly. So I think that we have to really confront some idols that are there, that are operative, and I think we have the vocabulary in our tradition. Youth is another one.
Oh, yes.
Medical technologies, perfection, and I think autonomy is sometimes an idol. And I say this as a person who is pro-choice, okay? But I think it's gone too far in some ways, and sometimes. So here's the other piece about imperfection. Farmer has achieved amazing results. So, and when you do talk to people who say it is not realistic, it is not possible, it is not pragmatic to change these structural differences, to really improve the lives of people in these poor countries, you just throw this book at them. Or maybe give it to them. And you go to the PIH website, Partners in Health website, and look at what they are doing. Against all odds and against all the naysayers. Now, however, having said that, the interviewer in the end of the book really talks to him about, this is not... How are you really going to change the world? I mean, you're not going to change the lives of all of these people. How can you recognize your own limits and such? And this is how Paul Farmer answers that question about winning, beating the odds versus losing. And so here's Farmer speaking. People from our background, like you, like most of the PIHers, like me, like doctors, we're used to being on the victory team. And actually, what we are really trying to do in Partners in Health is to make common cause with the losers. Now, those are two very different things. We want to be on the winning team, but at the risk of turning our backs on the losers? No. It's not worth it. So you fight the long defeat. Now, does that sound like a Lutheran statement or what? And he's Catholic, but I mean, we are going to do the right thing, not because it's going to earn our own salvation or that of other people, but because God has freed us to do the right thing. And even when the odds are against us and it looks like the world is not turning in the way that we would like, we are going to still be faithful because that is what God has created us and called us to do. We'll fight. You know, if by all statistics, if you want to look at the state of the world and how many people are Christians and what's happened since Jesus' death and resurrection, you could say we've not got the tangible results here. It doesn't look, it looks like we're fighting a long defeat. So we have two choices. We can just become cynical and sit in our butts and watch reality TV, or we can say, in spite of that, in spite of all that I cannot control, know, determine, I am going to still do what I believe God is calling me to do. Luther is quoted as saying, famously quoted as saying, if the world were to end tomorrow, or I knew that the world were going to end tomorrow, I'd plant an apple tree today. That's the best I've got. I'm not going to promise you that Obama or anyone else is going to make this whole new world. It's going to be beautiful and utopia on earth. But I do believe that real change is possible. And that that's better than none. And I have this kind of an example to help me have hope. Yes?
I think one of the things we struggle with, building a little bit on what Sonia said, is who gets to define common good?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a majority issue? Is it a minority issue? Is it people with unique insight? And to me, that crosses over all the time into issues of autonomy. And I think a really good practical example is the issue over who pays for tubal ligations or permanent sterilization. And so if you have federal Medicaid, you have to sign 30 days in advance or 72 hours, but still 30 days in advance of your due date, a federal slip that says I've received full and informed consent about what's going to be done. That's the only way your tubal ligation will be paid for.
Mm-hmm.
By the federal government. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if we don't oblige by those federal consent forms, mm-hmm. they can refuse to pay a cesarean section, an entire hospitalization, mm-hmm. all these sorts of things. Now, private payers don't have to do that.
Uh-huh.
So somehow we've set up a tree in our analysis that says, if you're on some form of federal assistance, you are not as capable of making good independent decisions mm-hmm. about your reproductive choice and health.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a law in effect since 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we don't have that law if anybody's receiving federal assistance for a vasectomy. Men, regardless of who's going to pay for their permanent sterilization, can choose to do it at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently women need a longer period of time
and we're not
to make
quite
that decision. We're not quite as good as
<Yeah.
laughs> so, but to me, the bigger issue is we have taken away a certain amount of autonomy from people. And because we've said that in the common good, we can't ever potentially coerce women,
mm-hmm.
which I understand the origination of this,
mm-hmm.
but somehow that's just to me an example where common good, so true common good from a worldwide perspective is limiting population growth, okay? So if everybody coupled up with one person and stayed with that person forever and they only have one child, we would solve a lot of problems in this world, right?
Yeah, so can I cut you off and respond to some of that? So first of all, I would say you're right that common good can, and this is where some people are really uncomfortable with what is called utilitarian ethics, maximizing the good for the most, because what if that doesn't work for you because you're in the minority?
Exactly.
So that means that, okay, so, well actually in a time in the United States history, slavery worked for the majority. So does that mean it's just, we keep it up? Okay, let's do it. You know, no. So, you have to constantly balance, again, both and here. I mean, there are places where women's rights are at such a different place than they are in for white educated Western women that we have to look at reproductive rights in terms of autonomy is not a done deal there. And the problem about the Bush policies on funding reproductive education and materials and such is that it is so tied to not talking about, let alone providing abortions, but not even talking about abortions, that they can't give information about it, that it has really constricted the funding. And the thing about women is that they need to know options and they need to have education. They also need material support so that they aren't having to sell their bodies and such just to survive. I mean, there's a whole lot of levels of what constitutes autonomy. Not simply saying, I'm an individual and I have rights, you know, being able to say that. But material, what are the material conditions for autonomy to be real? People have said, what is a good death? Autonomy. Well, what does it take for your voice to really carry weight? Not only in an advanced directive, but money, insurance, respectability, all these things can feed into what kind of choices you have. So choice is a huge and paramount concern. Instead of just saying, for the sake of everyone else, then your autonomy is going to be diminished. But there are ways, I think the process for holding those two intention then is through, whether it's church work, NGOs, United Nations, grassroots organizing, you know, the farmer model, it is getting these collaborative partnerships. I, as a white woman, don't think I can, from the United States, set the agenda for African women on exactly how they want to handle female circumcision or, you know, the questions of autonomy. I think, and Margaret Farley wrote a book that I didn't, it's on the resource list, it's called Just Love, which is a play on words, as in both just and then, oh, it's only love, you know. Just Love, and a framework of solidarity building and arriving at together with people from different social locations, what it means then, sexual ethics. How do we, what is protecting human autonomy or respecting life or dignity or voice? You know, how do we pragmatically construct those definitions out of dialogue? And one of the things I say when I'm speaking in academic conferences and such is that we as academics have to stop just talking to academics.
Yes.
If we're serious about doing social ethics that are worth what they're written on, then you have to interview people and dialogue with people and work with people and listen to people who are not in professional circles, whatever the ones are that you travel in. That's why I interviewed women in my book and the healthcare providers, because I knew that I could do all the data research and I could write it all down and I could add my own little theological spin, but that didn't have as much force or significance unless I checked out some things and revised some things based on what people lived. Obviously I didn't interview the whole world, but even a sampling in the beginning. So we have to hold those kinds of things in tension, and we have to think about the long defeat and not being afraid of that and still going forward. Now I want to get down to the concrete and talk about a few things in particular. What kinds of things would you like to see change? And I want you to brainstorm that with one another for a few minutes. And I've got my own list, but I want to hear from you and I want you to hear from each other. So let's see how much time we've got. It's now 20 after. So let's take 7 to 10 minutes to just brainstorm your own lists. What kinds of components to either international or national healthcare reform would you like to see? And then let's hear from you, and I will also give you what I think are both some things to move on and some ways to do it, some organizations that can help us. So turn your chairs, introduce yourselves, and just talk.
So it becomes a money issue. You can afford to go, but they're not as
you have to have human resources, one way or another. And there are ways to get around to all of them. Through supplemental insurance,
the mother become or the father. Consideration.
Yeah. patients are having.
So, to give us credit in all the thousands of dollars that we've been listening to this ethics talk, would need a lot of
So finish your sentence, your thought.
Knowing what you're saying, yes. And then the other thing that happens is that we saw that. So that's an answer.
I want the groups to do their work, but I'm an extrovert and I never know what to do with myself. I'm like a little caged animal, I know, but anyway. So, what do you want to lift up? What do you want others to not leave holding without hearing from your small groups about ideas for your own mobilization change action? You all are ethicists, you know. You're just not paid to do it. So, you have wisdom. Lisa, did you want to say something?
No. I was swatting at a fly.
Okay,
that's what my students used to say. Oh, it's just...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I didn't say this to the group, but the most important thing to me is what you said, that the people shouldn't just stay within their own, you know, like all the professors, to get out amongst the people, to break down the barriers. And by the way, I'm a Lutheran who taught in an Assembly of God school for a while. And we won the Martin Luther Jr. Writing Award for the state of Washington. And by the way, within that, gays were mentioned by our student, etc.
Wow.
And people think that change can't happen.
Right.
Change can happen if you just act normal with them. I'm not too normal, but you know, change can happen. So I think going outside of your group, that is the most important thing to me, is to go outside of your own group.
Show up for some conversation.
Show up where it's different from your little box beliefs.
And that's so important, and it's also sometimes challenging because, you know, we have this tradition of town hall meetings, and you know, when people did come to the courthouse and there'd be these public hearings, and now folks aren't, because of cars and suburbs and living rooms, and, you know, people kind of go get their individual news from their computer or their, so to try to even just create space.
Yeah,
not only to be willing as an individual, but help create space where those dialogues can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And help you show up and help others to show up. That's really important.
So, and the kids were 10 and 11, so it was a lot easier.
But you know what? When I talked with Latino immigrants in Pilsen in Chicago, because Loyola sponsored a couple of things that weren't just for academics, but for the Latino community about healthcare and healthcare disparities,
mm-hmm.
they are delighted.
Absolutely.
That others from Loyola or from city officials are actually in dialogue with them, and they're there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we just kind of, instead of expecting everybody to come to our church or our institution or our hospital, you know, go out in the communities.
Yeah.
And be there.
Instead of Lutherans, Catholics, and Episcopals always grouping, you know, jump over to the other side on some
various sides. Yeah,
various sides.
This is about religion, it's about nationality, it's about culture, it's about socioeconomic class, it's about race.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is in there. Other ideas that came up?
Healthcare. Mm-hmm. Healthcare.
Meaning?
For the masses.
For everybody.
So, let's say massive. Healthcare. Now, where you can go to get some ideas for that, there are a couple of places. You can certainly go to Obama's website, but you can also go to the Kaiser Family Foundation. This is on that resourcepage.org. And they give you specific information on what John McCain and Obama are proposing in terms of health care reform. So it's not just their own website promoting their plans, but it's independent analysis of those plans with data. KFF.org, Kaiser Family Foundation. KFF.org. It's on the resource sheet. Kaiser Family Foundation. The other one, if you want to know if Obama is being realistic or McCain is and what they proclaim about what they're going to do for healthcare or any other issue, oftentimes it's covered by factcheck.org. When they make statements and speeches about how much things are cost, or how their plan is different from another plan, you can see that rated. Another vehicle that's working on massive healthcare reform is Physicians for a National Healthcare Plan or Program. PNHP.org. Doctors, and you can check the American Nurses Association. And there are many professional organizations that are concerned about health care reform, that feel that they too are trapped by the current fragmented systems. You can then also look at, I'll get you in a second, the various models, because different states are moving ahead with different kinds of reforms. So you can follow what's happening in Vermont, Illinois, Massachusetts, what's being talked about in Florida, and just see how are things playing out, working, what kinds of models do we have, as well as what can we learn from other countries, even if we can't simply import their plan here. A lot of people think that Canadian healthcare is really scary, that the wait lines are interminable and that the quality is less. And there are some longer waits, and some Canadians do come to the United States because they want to move up a little faster in the line for various reasons. But on the other hand, they have a lower infant mortality rate and longer lifespans. And that is possibly part and due to their lifestyles and how much exercise they're getting and what they're eating. But it also has to do with something about basic public health and preventative health, safety net kinds of things happening that are more spotty or variable in this country. But it's not just Canada. There are a lot of other models. Yeah, go ahead.
What I know best, of course, is what nursing is doing. And I really think it's important, beside physicians, that we know that there are nurses that are staffing free clinics. Mm-hmm. Beside that clip on 50, 60 minutes, there are a lot of organizations that are doing that. And in the area of parish nursing, I'm thinking about churches, how we could encourage nurses to get out into the communities and to work. Mm-hmm. They want to do that. Churches are reluctant. I've tried two different churches to get a parish nursing program started. But, you know, and I think of public health. I just think of public health. Most people think nurses work in hospitals or clinics. That isn't true anymore. The majority are moving out into the community.
Yeah. So, obviously, I think that what you're making a very good point, which is that that should include a real emphasis on community preventative public health and such. Public health programs are not getting all the grants and the funding and the attention that they could use. And then a lot of times there are community programs, but people don't know about them. Like you were saying that, Chirsty, that the education gap or the information sharing to know what's in your community. So I think if in line with confronting our mortality and such, is can we pour more money into this kind of infrastructure, and not only about the latest drugs to treat end stages, cancers, brain tumors, you know, which is also really exciting. And, you know, if I had a family member die or have one of those conditions, I might really want a lot of time and energy and attention put on them. So I recognize that it's different when you're living with it yourself or a loved one. But still, I think the idea of focusing on, again, the common good, what is going to improve the health and well-being of the most.
We just have to find another color ribbon to associate with that. My pet peeve is everything being pink. I'm not saying breast cancer isn't important, but it's one disease.
And public health needs its own ribbon.
It does.
Go ahead, Kira.
And I would like to point out also that it's wonderful that what public health facilities are out there. But if you are, say, a single mother who works at a job and your public health clinic is an hour bus ride that way and an hour bus ride this way, you can't get there. And so access is a big deal. And so.
And childcare.
And childcare. You have to take an hour off from Walmart to go all the way across town to.
Not everybody gets doctor visits off time off of work.
Right. So my big deal is, if I wanted to leave here, is that if we want to start to address, we need to start at that level to expand our just basic health care so that people can get basic health care needs met. And it would really go a long way to avoiding a lot of emergency room visits and mental health care coverage, because it is not given parity, no matter what anybody will tell
you.
You get a few sessions and you better be better.
I work for a hospital, and I'm sorry to say, our mental health coverage is pretty horrible. And I work next to the mental health unit. And I think, if I worked in there, how would I feel about how they value what I do? So, and it's huge mental health care.
So let me run down my laundry list, and you can take it or leave it or think about it. I think the first thing that we can do as Christians, both as individuals and as people of faith, is bring our theological insights, those metaphors and images that I had up before, bring those to the table, share them, talk about them, don't hide them under a bushel, in other words. And along with that is to actively dispel myths about racial ethnic minorities, about people living in other countries and what their conditions are like, in terms of the uninsured, that myth, the 10 myths on the uninsured from the Kaiser Family Foundation that I passed around. Don't discount the power of sharing information. Mm-hmm. That is huge. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think in those of us who are working professional circles related to healthcare, or those of us who are family members who are healthcare providers, or those of us who have other kinds of inroads and connections there, I think we need to keep working on educating providers to see their own stereotypes and assumptions. Not because they're any different than the rest of us, but because they are like the rest of us. We all have assumptions and stereotypes, and we all could use more awareness of our social locations. That needs to happen in nursing school and in medical schools. Some do it very well, others do not. And then ongoing throughout medical professional training and experience. But there are some people who really get that, and there are others who don't. And I think that it's a culture of education that we could help to revise. But apart from that, we need to increase leadership of color and of various races and nationalities in other places. As in, it's got to be the lay community health workers from these communities, not simply well-intentioned white people wanting to go in and change or take care of people. We need to really empower various communities. Why this is important is because when there is race concordance or cultural concordance, oftentimes building trust between patients and providers, not always, but can go a lot easier and better, because they look at the person as, yes, educated, but who would understand where I'm coming from. Right now in the United States, listen to this. Okay, so there are about 15% of the US population is Latino, and 12% is African American, or 13% rather. Well, Latinos make up 2% of registered nurses, 3.4% of psychologists, and 3.5% of physicians. And while 1 in 8 Americans is black, fewer than 1 in 20 physicians or dentists is black. So, if I want a white person or a woman as my provider, I can usually find that. Not everybody has that luxury in terms of finding who their providers are. And that's related to number 5, which is, and this is 6, I think we need to support both choice and continuity of care. That means people, if they don't like their doctor's side of care, should have some ability to change it up. But they should also be able to keep the doctors that they like, and the nurses, and the sites of care. If you are without insurance, or you have Medicaid, and you're in end-of-life care, you have very little choice in where you go, what nursing homes will accept you, and who your doctor is. Choice is not as easy to come by, depending on your socioeconomic status. So this, to me, does get back to what you all said. We need massive healthcare reform. As much as I like the idea of supporting the nurses and the doctors who are doing this great work, we have got to structurally make some changes. Now, is there any form of socialized medicine in existence in the United States right now? Medicaid is, in a sense, but it's a partnership between states and federal government, so it varies a lot.
Yeah, it does vary.
Medicare is federal. Now, you who are Medicare, do you get to pick your own doctors?
Yeah.
You do, don't you?
Yeah.
Do you have long wait times? Well, I mean, but it's not like there's only, it's completely limited, right? You do have a range. There are questions around the prescription drug coverage, I know, but it has a much lower overhead, an administrative cost to it, than anything else in the United States. Is it perfect? No, but it is a model of federal health care, just like another model being that with the House of Representatives and the Senate and other government officials get. Yeah.
Isn't that one of the proposals by somebody to expand Medicare?
Carrie in 2004.
Yeah, tried to say that's one way we could start.
Yep, and Clinton's plan is more similar. Obama is working with more private insurers and such and trying to do kind of a combination of things. He wants to bring people, he doesn't want to do a top-down approach, he says, but have it more come from the various sectors and collaboration and dialogue. It may work, and we can just push him hard and keep pushing to say, yeah, but make sure that you aren't leaving people out by doing this, and that you are holding the health care lobby and the health insurance lobby accountable and stuff. So we'll see how it goes. We're just running out of time, so I need to finish this real quick. We can draw attention on global and U.S. health and healthcare realities. That's related to one, but I mean, what if you hosted a dialogue on Paul Farmer's book, either The Pathologies of Power or the book about him, Tracy Kidder? What if you guys did get folks together and read chapters and to do justice? Because there are great discussion questions at the end. What if you showed people the videos that I showed this week? That kind of presentation and leadership. And then saying, hey, let's go to that political rally. Let's go to that town hall meeting. Don't underestimate how much that can change the world in bits and pieces. And finally, I want you to know I made a couple copies of Sojourner's August 2008, Healing in the Common Good, Six Myths About Single-Payer Healthcare. The whole issue, the cover story, is on healthcare reform, and the lead article is written by Elizabeth Edwards. So I just photocopied this one page, but go and get the Sojourner's magazine from August 2008. So take one of those. This is the resources page that I mentioned that lists, I think, everything that I've used this week. And finally, here are some examples of fact check. Oh my gosh, I almost forgot to mention Kaiser Family Foundation and what they do and the information they have. And finally, write down this website, faithinthepubliclife.org. Actually, no, the. It's just faithinpubliclife.org. They are mobilizing progressive Christians on a number of issues, keeping folks informed. This is just a list of all the healthcare links that they have. Documents from various faith traditions advocating for healthcare reform. They tell you about meetings in various states and things going on, legislative proposals. Tremendous resource. Faith in public life. It's also on the resource page, but you can just take a look at what they're doing on healthcare right now. Thanks for an amazing week. It's been a real gift to be with you all. Thank you.